a sign first from a Booker winner. I hope that you'll be with us next week on Wednesday, the 16th, when Elizabeth Gilbert will be here, and she is going to be in conversation with the amazing Kelly Corrigan. If you've been seeing the reviews of Elizabeth's book, The Signature of All Things, you know that the critics are raving. And of course, you'll want to be here on November 7th when the great poet Billy Collins will be with us, and on Saturday, November 16th, when Giada will be giving us comfort food. You can get tickets for all of these at Book Passage, and I want to see you at every lecture. I would really appreciate it if you would turn your cell phones off at this moment, and also if you, during the lecture, you would not use flash cameras. Because it's distracting for other people. And I'm going to go away now and let the real official introducers get going. But I really want to thank you for supporting this lecture series and supporting Dominican and Book Passage. We are so thrilled to be part of this great community. See you later.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Dominican University of California. Are you happy to be here this evening? Thank you. We're thrilled to have you. The Leadership Lecture Series, in partnership with Book Passage, has been just a joy for us. This is our 81st lecture that we've done with Elaine and Bill Petrocelli in Book Passage. So will we thank them for their partnership, please? Thank you for that. And I also hope you buy their books. My name is Denise Lucy. I am a professor of business and organizational studies at our School of Business and Leadership, and I just am so thrilled to be here this evening to welcome you. And our lecture series is really one part of our institute. It's a place to bring our community in, to join our students and faculty, and to talk about leadership across the disciplines. So for those of you who have been here before, thank you for coming again. I wonder if I could see a wave of hands of those who've never attended before. Quite a few. Where have you been? You need to return. Well, of course, as a professor of leadership and organizations, I'm thrilled. I'm an admirer of Mr. Gladwell's writings, as those of us in the classroom around the country inspire our students with his writing. The Tipping Point, for example, it's a way to stand up and make a difference. And as he said, it's a way to spread like wildfire when you can stand and be counted. His newest work speaks of the balance between the powerful and the dispossessed. The use of power is a concept in leadership. Either you use it, you abuse it. And I'm really interested to hear what he has to say tonight, as are our students and faculty in the audience. For those of you who are not aware, we record these lectures and we post them on our Dominican website, and also a live podcast on Penguin Radio. You can also get that podcast later on our website. As well, on Wednesday nights on Channel 30, Public TV also re-airs our programming with Book Passage. Our lead sponsor is Private Ocean Wealth Management, and they have been exceptionally supportive of us. This is their third season where they have provided our lead sponsorship, and without their help, we could not provide these programs. Yes, let's thank Private Ocean. You know, I'm just going to do a little plug for them because they deserve it. They've been named 7 times by Worth Magazine as the top 100 registered investment firms in the nation, and just this year, they've been voted the best wealth management firm in the North Bay by the North Bay Biz. And I just want to thank Private Ocean Wealth Management for their continued support. Thank you. And let's give a big shout out for our students, our faculty, and our staff who volunteered this evening to welcome you to our campus. Thank you. So I would like to introduce Richard Stone, who is the co-founder and the chairman of the board for Private Ocean Wealth Management. He happens also to be on our board of trustees as our chair of our finance committee. He has served 40 years in the field of wealth management. And he's received a prestigious award by Charles Schwab Impact Leadership for Lifetime Achievement. And it is my pleasure and honor to introduce to you Mr. Richard Stone.
Good evening. Our guest speaker tonight, Malcolm Gladwell, is a journalist, public speaker, and author whose first four books were on the New York Times bestseller list, including the renowned Tipping Point, probably a classic in business literature. He's a columnist for the New Yorker, where he has been on staff since 1996. Prior to that, he was a reporter for the Washington Post. Born in England and reared in Canada, Mr. Gladwell's provocative ideas have taken the business world by storm. In 1999, his profile of Ron Propeal, an inventor and well-known infomercial salesman, won a national magazine award. Mr. Gladwell has been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people and one of foreign policy's top global thinkers. He's been honored by the American Psychological Society and the American Sociological Society. In 2011, Mr. Gladwell was appointed to the Order of Canada, the centerpiece of the Canadian honors system that recognizes a lifetime of outstanding achievement, dedication to the community, and service to its nation. Mr. Gladwell was inspired to be a writer by his mother, a Jamaican-born psychotherapist. He interned with National Journalism Center in Washington, D.C., graduated with a degree in history from the University of Toronto's Trinity College, and ultimately covered business and science for the Washington Post. It's kind of a nice transition from history to science and business, but it worked for him very well. In addition to the Tipping Point, he has written international bestsellers, What the Dog Saw, Outliers, and Blink. In his latest book, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants, Mr. Gladwell examines our understanding of advantages and disadvantages, arguing that we have underestimated the value of adversity and overestimated the value of privilege. Please join me in welcoming best-selling author and award-winning journalist, Malcolm Gladwell.
So much. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you all for coming. There was a little reception beforehand, and I made an observation which I'm going to repeat. And the reason I'm going to repeat it is that that's what you do when you're on a book tour. You just repeat every good line you have. The observation was that my book tour began at the 92nd Street Y in New York last week, which is the Jewish Y, right? And then I flew the next day to LA and I gave a talk at that new refurbished synagogue on Wilshire. And then I came up to San Francisco and yesterday I did an event sponsored by the JCC. you can see where I'm going with this. You can imagine how delighted I was to come to an event at a university called Dominican and to learn that there are people outside the Jewish community who are interested in my work. it's enormously comforting. I'm gonna do something a little bit different tonight. I'm gonna tell you a story, but it's not a story found in my book. And there's a reason for that, and that is that it's weird to talk for 45 minutes about something that is actually in the book that you're all going to take home with you. You know, you see a trailer for a movie, it's 1 minute, and the movie is 2 hours. But this is going to be 45 minutes. I mean, it just seemed like I would be stepping on the experience of reading my book. I want it to be fresh. So I'm going to tell a story that's not in the book, but which reflects on one of the great themes of the book. Had the book been longer, I might well have told this story. The theme of that I'm interested in is, like I said, it's a big theme of the book, is this question of why is it that underdogs fight? What is it that, you know, history is replete with examples of people who are marginalized and excluded, who nonetheless fight bravely and to the finish against people much more powerful than them. And we're always left with the question of what motivated those people? What led them to keep fighting long after the odds seemed overwhelmingly stacked against them? And the story I want to tell, I think, shed some light upon that. It's a story about a woman named Alva Smith, who's one of the great unsung heroes of the 20th century, and she ends up playing an enormously important role in the suffragette movement in the early part of the 20th century. And one of the many reasons she's interesting is that there is, on paper at least, absolutely nothing in the story of Alva Smith that would explain why she fought the way she did so long and so hard for the cause of women's rights. And you can only figure out her motivation by looking a little deeper into her story. And so that's what I thought I would do tonight as a way of reflecting on one of the big themes of my book. So Alva Smith has three names. Alva Belmont is the name that she dies with. Alva Vanderbilt is the name that she was most famous for having. And Alva Smith is a name that she was born with. And that's a good place to start. She was born in Mobile, Alabama. Her father was a moderately prosperous businessman who moves the family when she's quite young to New York. And Alva, as a child, is a piece of work. She is this difficult, obstreperous, ungovernable, impossible child who would break out into tantrums and who was, her first memory is being horrified at the knowledge, the understanding that little boys looked down on her because she was a girl. She was short. She had a very severe face. She had long hair that stretched all the way down her back and turned prematurely gray when she was in her 20s. One of her good friends once described her as looking like a Pekingese, which might be inaccurate. She, a better example, a better way of phrasing that might be that she looked like, or at least acted like, a pit bull. But she has enormous ambitions for herself, and one of the things that she realizes when she grows up is that if she's going to make something out of her life in New York, she's going to need money, and her family doesn't have any. So she casts her eye on the eligible young men of New York until her eye lands on a young man named Willie Vanderbilt, who is this handsome, charming, spoiled playboy who just happens to be the grandson of Commodore Vanderbilt, who in the 19th century is one of the richest men in the world. They marry. She bears him a daughter named Consuelo and two sons, and then she embarks on one of the greatest flights of conspicuous consumption in the history of conspicuous consumption. And I feel like, as residents of the Bay Area, you know all about conspicuous consumption. First thing she does is buy 800 acres on Long Island Sound and constructs a cottage in shingles as the kind of country estate. Then she buys a whole block at Fifth Avenue and 52nd Street, and she builds a French-style chateau, which costs, in $1,900, $3 million. Which works out to a couple hundred million in today's dollars. And to give you a sense of what this cottage was like, I'm going to read to you an account of this house from one of the many books on the real estate portfolio of Alva Vanderbilt. And all of these books are exercises in what might be called real estate porn. Everywhere was everything. Walls of red African marble, I didn't even know there was red African marble, of stamped leather, walls hung with blue silk brocade, with red velvet embroidered with leaves, flowers and butterflies, enriched with cut crystal and precious stones, ceilings of mahogany, of bronze, of colored glass, of bamboo, wainscoting of rosewood inlaid with mother of pearl and brass, ebony inlaid with ivory, polished ebony inlaid with satinwood, and Oriental, Elizabethan, English, Renaissance, French, and Victorian touches in crowded rooms bursting with bronze, stained glass, marble mosaics, and friezes. Then she decides she wants a yacht, and it's the largest private yacht ever built, 285 feet. And it's called the Alva, of course. Then it has a staff of 52. Then she decides she wants a country cottage, and she goes to Newport, and she builds this cottage. And the best thing that can be said, or the most succinct way of describing this cottage, is that Alva had to import 500 cubic feet of white marble from Italy just to do the facade. So now she has the city house, the country house, the cottage, and the yacht, and she turns her attention to her daughter, Consuelo. And Consuelo was always this very shy girl, but Alva had the highest of expectations for her. She raised her according to a very, very strict regimen. Consuelo was permitted to only speak French to her parents. Every Friday, she had to recite a long poem in German. She had to wear a corset with one of those steel rods in the back to preserve her posture. If she did the slightest thing wrong in public, she would be mercilessly corrected by her mother. And as Consuelo enters adolescence, Alva gets it into her head that what she really wants to do is to marry her daughter off into English royalty. Now, this is something that was quite common at the time. This was there was a whole practice in the late 19th century of the daughters of very, very wealthy American millionaires to be married off to the penurious heirs of the English aristocracy. There was actually a term for it. It was called cash for class. And in typical fashion, Alva sets her sights on the absolute greatest catch of them all, who is a young man, a 23-year-old man named Charles Richard John Spencer Churchill. He is otherwise known as Sonny. He is the 9th Duke of Marlborough. He is the first cousin of Winston Churchill. He is the lineal ancestor of Lady Diana, and he is heir to one of the largest houses in the world, Blenheim Palace, which takes up 7 acres and makes Alva's house on 57th and 5th look like a ranch-style bungalow. And Blenheim Palace is falling apart, and Sonny does not have the money to fix it. And the minute Alva realizes that, she realizes that he's a perfect match for her daughter. Now, there are two problems with this idea. The first is that Sonny is not Sonny. He's the most miserable of men. And to give you some sense of how miserable he is, his second wife, Emily Deacon, would sleep with a pistol by her bed in case he should come to her in the middle of the night. The second problem is that Consuelo is in love with someone else, a young man named Wintry Rutherford. And Wintry was an Adonis. He was an athlete. He was a dancer. He was devilishly handsome. He came from one of the most accomplished families in all of New York. And he begins to woo Consuelo. And on her 18th birthday, he sends her a rose, a single red rose with no card, but she knows who it's from. And then not long thereafter, she goes on a bicycle ride with Wintry and her mother chaperoning. And at one point, just before a curve in the road, Wintry and Consuelo speed up, and as they go around the corner out of sight of Alva, Wintry hastily proposes to Consuelo. And Alva is like trying to keep up with pumping as fast as her little legs can carry her. And the minute Alva looks at the look on her daughter's face, she understands what's just happened. And she, the next day, whisks Consuelo off to Paris. And Wintry writes letter after letter to his loved one, and each one of those letters is intercepted by Alva and confiscated. And then Wintry comes to Paris to try and meet up with Consuelo, and Alva won't let him in the house. And then Alva takes Consuelo, and they go to the cottage in Newport, And Wintry comes back to try and meet up with Consuelo, and Alva forbids her daughter from leaving the house. She locks her daughter up like Rapunzel. And finally, Consuelo's had enough, and she climbs the long stairs to her mother's opulent bedroom with the cherubs holding shields emblazoned with the letter A. And she confronts her mother and says, "I'm engaged to marry Wintry. You can't stop me from marrying the man I love." And Alva rises up in all of her Pekingese glory and says, "You are going to be a duchess." Right? And Consuelo looks back at her mother defiantly, and Alva flies into a rage because no one defies Alva Vanderbilt. And she denounces Wintry using every invective under the sun. And Consuelo realizes that it's hopeless. It's no, you can't fight Alva Vanderbilt. It's impossible. And she gives up. And on November 6th, 1895, New York witnesses one of the grandest weddings ever seen before or since in St. Thomas's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue. The daughter of one of the wealthiest men in the world is married off to one of the princes of English royalty, and Alva hires 80 decorators to fill the church with wild flowers and white roses, and she puts on this satin dress lined with a border of Russian sable, and she marches down the aisle with her two young sons escorting her, and she stands at the front and waits for her daughter, and waits first 5 minutes, then 10 minutes, and outside it's this massive spectacle, and every reporter in the country is straining at the barricades, and there is Alva standing there, and why isn't her daughter showing up? Because her daughter is still back home, sobbing inconsolably in the arms of her father. Finally, they clean up Consuelo, and they bring her to the church, and she marries Sonny, and Alva immediately whisks them into a back room of behind the church, and they sign the prenup, and Sonny gets $2.5 million up front and $100,000 a year for life, and then they climb into a carriage, and they drive away, and Sonny turns to Consuelo, and he informs her that A, he doesn't love her, and he never will, and B, she should be clear about what her responsibilities are, to bear him an heir and to fix Blenheim Palace. Meanwhile, on the church steps, Alva is standing there in her satin and her Russian sable, and she watches them pull away, and there are tears in her eyes, right? She's this girl from Mobile, Alabama, and now she is the mother of a duchess. This is Alva's moment of greatest triumph, or so it seems, because things quickly get more complicated. Now, you can see, I think, why I refer to Alva as a very unlikely radical. Exceedingly rich people are not often agents of great social change, particularly exceedingly rich people whose principal indulgence is building enormous, grotesque houses. And marrying off their daughters into English royalty. So how do we account for the fact that Alva ended up taking this peculiar turn? Well, I think in order to answer that question, it's worth taking a little detour to ponder the broader question of what does motivate people to defy authority? Now, that's obviously an enormous issue, but there are a couple of theories about this. The principal theory, the one that most people would accept as being the most important, is the idea that obedience to authority is created through the use of deterrence. That deterrence is about costs and benefits. That if you want people to obey the law, you have to make sure that the costs of breaking the law are greater than the benefits of breaking the law. If people commit crimes, it means that the penalties aren't serious enough, right? And this sounds like perfect common sense. In fact, we can all point to examples of this. The one that criminologists love to talk about is the famous police strike of Montreal in 1970. The police went on strike in Montreal for 19 hours in the summer of 1970, and the city of Montreal descended into chaos. There were gun battles in the streets. There were so many banks robbed that day that the banks all shut down. It was utter pandemonium. This is Canada that we're talking about, right? If you lower the cost of committing a crime to zero, people are going to commit crimes. The problem with this idea, though, is that there are all kinds of cases where that theory doesn't seem to work. So take the example of paying your taxes. One of the most common activities that everyone in the modern world is engaged in. It turns out there's a huge difference in the level of tax compliance, tax honesty, among different countries, right? There are countries like Greece and Italy where basically only a small fraction of people are honest when it comes to tax day. And there are countries like the United States where people are exceedingly honest. The difference between the US and Greece and Italy is enormous, right? The size of their underground economy in Greece is something like three times on a per capita basis the size of the underground economy in the United States. You know, on April 15th, for one reason or another, we are incredibly honest in this country. So if deterrence is the theory that explains people's behavior, that must mean that in countries like the United States, where everyone pays their taxes, the penalties of cheating on your taxes must be really high. So are they? No. The penalties for tax cheating in America are incredibly low. They're among the lowest in the developed world. Basically, most of the time, the IRS just makes you pay back taxes plus a penalty. And that the audit rates in the United States are lower than almost every country in the world. Your chances of getting caught if you cheat are minimal. Now, don't take that to heart, but it doesn't make any sense, in other words. Here's another complication. If deterrence really matters, then in instances where jurisdictions dramatically increase the penalties associated with crime, you should see a dramatic drop in crime. Is that the case? Well, not really. The great example is, of course, the state of California, right? 20 years ago, California embarked on what has been called the greatest penal experiment in American history. Actually, that's putting it too modestly. The three strikes law passed 20 years ago was one of the greatest experiments in the history of the world when it comes to criminal justice. Overnight, the penalties for committing certain crimes were raised from this to this. You all remember this. You lived through this, right? So if deterrence matters, you should have seen a dramatic drop in the crime rate in California after the advent of three strikes. Did that happen? Well, we can't figure out whether it happened. Crime did drop after three strikes, but then it also dropped in every other state in the union, even in states that did nothing to make their criminal justice system more severe. In fact, if you look at all of the studies that have been done over the years on the effect of three strikes, they're all over the place. Some say it worked, some say it didn't, some say it raised crime, some say it lowered. You can find very, very credible studies that make a very good argument that as a result of three strikes, the crime rate in California is actually higher today than it would have been otherwise, right? It's not clear at all that deterrence worked when it came time to when you look at the California example. As a result of all of these problems with the idea of deterrence, a whole group of scholars have come up with a competing theory. They've said, look, maybe that's a part of it, but there's a broader explanation here. And that has to do with the idea that people obey authority not because of the content of the laws, but rather as a result of the way the law is enforced. People obey laws when they perceive laws as being legitimate. Now, what does that mean? Legitimacy has three pillars. Something is perceived as legitimacy, as legitimate, when it gives the people who are subject to the law voice. When you feel like if you are being treated unfairly, you can speak up and be heard, right? The second prong of legitimacy is that people perceive something as legitimate when the administration of law is neutral, when one group doesn't get a better deal than another, right? And the third pillar of legitimacy is that people see something as legitimate when they feel like the administration of the law is trustworthy. When you when you think that something's not going to change overnight that dramatically affects the way you're being treated. Now, with those three ideas in mind, think back to the example of taxes. Why are Americans so incredibly honest on tax day? Not because we're scared by the incredible penalties leveled by the IRS. No, because we perceive our system as being legitimate. Now, I know that we in this country are constantly arguing and complaining and moaning about our government and our tax system, but compared to almost any other country in the world, we have it really good, right? Do you think you can be heard if you have a complaint about your taxes? Oh, yeah. In fact, you can argue this political system does a better job of listening to people complain about taxes than almost any other function, right? Does our tax system treat people in an arbitrary fashion? Do some people get a much better break than others? Well, a little bit, but it's pretty fair, right? You know the rules. And do the rules change dramatically from year to year so that you can't trust the system? No, they're pretty consistent. If you look at the tax policy over time, you have a good expectation about what your taxes are going to be tomorrow. Now compare that to Greece. Why don't people pay their taxes in Greece? Because they perceive their system as being completely illegitimate. Right? It's corrupt. People pay off the tax inspectors. People cut special deals. They bribe this, that, and the other thing. There are whole categories of Greek life that are weirdly exempt from taxes. The system is a complete mess. And as a result, no one believes in it. Right? They don't think they have voice. They don't think it's impartial. They don't find it trustworthy. And why didn't three strikes have a discernible effect on the crime rate in California? Well, maybe if you lock up as many criminals as you did here in California, and let's not forget that the prison population of California during the era of three strikes doubled to the point where the per capita prison population of California was seven times what it is in Western Europe and in Canada. Seven times, right? Maybe, and this is a statistic I'll never forget, which is, If you look at black male high school dropouts born in the 1970s, 69% of them have spent time behind bars. Basically, during that era, the era of three strikes, this country took an entire generation of men and locked them up. Now, if you come from the same community as those men who were locked up, do you perceive the system that's locking them up as legitimate? If you're living in one of those neighborhoods where people are getting life imprisonment for stealing a slice of pizza, as happened in California, right? Do you think you have voice? Do you think the system treats you as fairly as any other group? Do you think there's there is consistency and trust in the way the law is administered? Of course not. So what happens in systems where there is no legitimacy? People rebel. They get angry. Right? They feel under no compulsion to obey the law. Right? In Greece, that's why people don't pay their taxes. In poor communities around this country, that's why crime continues to be a problem. Nothing serves as a greater engine of defiance than the condition of being denied neutrality and denied voice. Right? Which brings us back to Alva, because she lived in a society that she felt did not grant her legitimacy. Now, I realize that seems hard to believe because here she is, this spoilt rich woman with a 280-foot yacht with 52 people on it and enormous houses all around the country. You know, she ordered her family around. She was this pit bull. How could she possibly feel that she was denied legitimacy? Well, the truth is that she occupied a world that was incredibly narrow and oppressive. A woman's place in late 19th century and early 20th century America was severely circumscribed. You could plan parties, you could hold dinners, you could have lunch with your lady friends, and that was it. You couldn't work, you couldn't vote, you couldn't participate meaningfully in any kind of public life. You were expected to stay at home and keep up a respectful appearance. Meanwhile, what were the men up to? Well, the men could do whatever they wanted. Leave the house whenever they wanted, do whatever they wanted, work if they wanted to. They spent the evenings at their clubs. They ran free. The way the divorce laws were written at the time, if a man wanted to divorce a woman, all he had to do was to allege infidelity. If a woman wanted to divorce a man, she had to prove both infidelity and some kind of physical cruelty. A rich man in that era could indulge every whim they had, right? And they did. The rich men in the world of the Vandermilts went off on their yachts, and they would bring along scores of call girls, and they would have wild parties, and they would have mistresses stashed in apartments around the city. You know, Willie Vanderbilt, Alva's husband, was no exception. He was this complete playboy. He didn't work. He inherited this gigantic fortune. He was handsome and charming, and he had one affair after another, right? While Alva was required to stay at home playing the dutiful wife. In those years leading up to her daughter's marriage, it looked like she was this kind of triumphant hostess, right, in charge of her domain. In fact, she was desperately unhappy. She would later describe those years as the saddest of her life. She and Willie had begun to argue. She had become aware of his various infidelities. And she had met a man who she felt she really loved, a guy named Oliver Belmont. But there was nothing she could do about that, right? A woman couldn't have an affair like a man could, not a woman in her position. Men could have affairs, but not women. And so her only choice is to stick it out in this marriage. And so she turns to her husband and she says, let's try and save our marriage. And so the family takes a trip to Paris, but it's a disaster. Over the course of the time in Paris, she discovers that her husband is not just having an affair with her best friend, whose name is Consuelo, the woman who she named her daughter after, but also simultaneously with a French prostitute. And she's had enough. She orders him out of the house, and she demands a divorce. And everyone in her world tells her, you can't do that. No one divorces in our circle. The lawyer she engages to handle the divorce petition says, I won't do it, urges her not to do it. Right? The tabloids, as you can imagine, go crazy. One of the richest men in America, richest women in America, has thrown her husband out of the house and wants a divorce. She goes to Trinity Church in Newport, a church she's gone to her entire adult life, and all of her people she thought were her friends turn their backs on her, right? They completely ostracize her. They won't even acknowledge her anymore. But she feels she has no choice, right? The situation is impossible. And later in her, she writes her memoirs, and she has this incredibly poignant passage about what she was feeling at the time and about the plight of women in that era. She says, it was considered religious, dignified, and correct for the wife to withdraw into the shadows while her husband paid the family respects to the sunshine. She was supposed to get her sunlight by proxy through the husband. That's a heartbreaking phrase, right? Sunlight by proxy. And I think that helps to put a lot of her behavior into perspective. Here is this brilliant, ambitious woman, right? In today's world, she would be an entrepreneur. She would start some business. She would go on to all kinds of greatness. At the time, all of that is denied to her. So what outlet does she have all of her enormous energies? Well, the only thing she can do is to build houses, right? And that's the only option available to a woman with that kind of energy in her class at that time. And it looks like this kind of grotesque, conspicuous assumption, but that's a very narrow and uncharitable reading of what she was up to. She needed a project to feel fulfilled, and building houses was the only project she could find. She's completely frustrated by the society that she lives in, right? That also, I think, makes sense of her seemingly inexcusable behavior about her daughter's betrothed, Wintry Rutherford. Consuelo was 18 at the time she meets Wintry. Wintry was 33 years old. He came from a family best known, in the words of the tabloids at the time, for wearing expensive clothing. He spends his days playing golf and polo at the Newport Country Club. She looks at him and she sees another version of her own husband, this handsome, idle, decadent, philandering man who's going to sentence her daughter to a lifetime of misery and uselessness. And in contrast, what did the Duke of Marlborough represent? Well, he may have been a miserable sort as well, But at least she would be the Duchess if she married him. She would have standing in her society. She'd have a position. She'd have the ability to speak out and be heard and be listened to and be acknowledged, right? She could command a real position and make a name for herself. Now, to our modern eyes, ears, that sounds like an incredibly cynical calculation that we made. Consuelo was in love with Wintry, and we believe in marrying for love. But in 1900, when women were a little more than property, that was, in Alba's eyes, love was an impossible luxury, right? Consuelo was her great hope. Consuelo was her beloved daughter, and she was not going to let her daughter squander her life the way she felt her own life had been squandered. So in that moment when Consuelo pulls away in the carriage with Sonny, and Alva is standing on the church steps weeping, those aren't tears of joy necessarily, right? It's not this moment of heartless triumph. It's a tragic moment. Here's a woman who's had to make these incredibly impossible choices. She's had to alienate her own daughter in order to save her. She's been humiliated by her husband and has had no choice but to turn her back on him and divorce him, and in so doing has earned the scorn and ridicule and hatred of her own society, right? She's a woman who's in hell, but she doesn't turn back. And why not? Because she does not accept society's judgment of her as legitimate. They haven't given her standing. She doesn't have voice. She's not allowed to speak up. She's supposed to shut her mouth and be quiet and hide in the house. Her world doesn't treat her with neutrality. No, there's one set of rules for women and one set of rules for men. Alva, at that moment, is in the position that all radicals are in the beginning. She's in that position that all radicals are at the moment of their transformation, and that is that she's angry. Now, one of the questions that I deal with in my book and spend a lot of time trying to figure out is, why is it so hard for people in positions of power to appreciate the significance of this kind of anger? Right? I have a chapter in the book about Northern Ireland, and I spent a lot of time in Belfast 2 summers ago, and I remember going to a conference in memory of a shooting that had taken place in a part of Belfast called Ballymurphy. Some British soldiers had shot a number of civilians, and it was the 30th anniversary of the shooting. And I sat in the back of a room like this, with as many people in it as are in this room right now. And the thing that blew me away was how raw the emotion was in the room, even 30 years after the shooting. People in England had forgotten about it. They'd moved on. They never gave it a second thought. It was an unfortunate moment in an unfortunate war that, to their minds, had been consigned to the history books. It had not been consigned to the history books in Belfast, in the neighborhood of Ballymurphy. I think about the same thing when I look at all of the military adventures this country has entered into over the last 10 years, right? Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan. We've had these debates about all those military operations, and those debates are always about our tactics and our strategy and our aims and the weapons we use. And it seems to me very rarely that we bring up what is the most important question of all, which is, how are we being perceived, right? Is our intervention in those places perceived by the people we are trying to help as legitimate? Or are we leaving a residue of anger that will be there for generations after we have left and gone home, right? It strikes me that we need to learn to rethink the way we use our power and to appreciate just how important and how significant and how ominous this kind of anger can be. So back to Alva. Here we have this profoundly rich and very angry woman. She's been denied legitimacy by the society of which she's a part, and she's a ticking time bomb, right? And in the greatest of ironies, the charge that sets her off turns out to be her own daughter. In the years of her marriage to Sonny, Consuelo is transformed. She bears him two sons. She would always refer to them as an heir and a spare. And she stays with him for 10 years, and then she leaves him. And she conducts herself with such dignity, and everyone in London society is aware of what a complete jerk Sonny is, that no one holds it against her. They all rally around her. And she becomes this extremely important figure in the philanthropic world in the England of that time. She develops this powerful social conscience, and she is this tall, beautiful, incredibly charismatic person who begins to speak out on all manner of social injustice. And in 1908, she comes back to New York triumphantly, and she gives a famous speech at the Waldorf Astoria. And she stands up in front of all of the assembled society women of New York, and she talks to them about her experience in England. And what she has discovered in her time in England is that in England, a woman actually does have a real chance to speak out. England does recognize that women have a role to play in public affairs. And in her speech, she basically chides the women of New York for not agitating for the same rights and responsibilities. She basically tells them that they're sheep, right? They are slaves to their men, and it's time for them to stand up and to be counted. And as she says this, Alva, her mother, is sitting in the audience, and you can only imagine how she feels. She sent her daughter away a decade before in tears, right? Because she thought that only by leaving America could she save Consuelo. And now Consuelo is back, and what has she found out? That her daughter has been saved, right? And Consuelo and Alva have a talk afterwards, and Consuelo turns to her mother and says, you know, in spite of all that happened, I am glad I married an Englishman. And it's as if Alva has been offered absolution. A weight has been lifted off her shoulders. The burden of guilt has been removed. And not long after that, she goes to hear a speech. And the lecture is on the suffragette movement. And at that time, of course, women in most of the American states and in most of the countries throughout the world couldn't vote or had very, very limited voting rights. And Alva is transfixed by this cause because she realizes that this is the route to legitimacy, that only when women can stand up and can vote and to have their preferences listened to, will they ever have a chance to stand as equals alongside men. And she looks at the campaign for women's rights at that time, and she realizes that it's in trouble. It lacks resources, it lacks visibility, it lacks energy, it lacks any kind of strategic vision, and these are all things that she can supply in droves, right? So she barges in and she takes over, and she moves the headquarters of the suffragette movement from Warren, Ohio, where it had been before, to Fifth Avenue in New York, and she sets them up in a proper building, and she starts to build an organization. And when she loans out her cottage in Newport for suffragette conventions, to the horror of her fancy neighbors, right? And when a group of female garment workers in New York, the most oppressed and abused minority in the working world of that time, go on strike to protest the abysmal way they had been treated by their bosses, Alva comes to their aid, and she's the one who leads the march through downtown. And when they're all arrested, she's the one who puts up bail, and she's the one who stands and sits in the courtroom throughout the long night after they've been arrested and glares at the judge until he lets them out, right? She's the first person to stand up and say that black women have a role in a suffragette movement, which they hadn't until that time. And when the movement grows conservative and people start saying, oh, maybe we shouldn't be doing this, we're antagonizing men, Alva's the one who stands up and says, what do you mean? Men don't worry about antagonizing men. Why should we? And throughout all the years of the First World War, when many people in the suffragette movement said, this is not a time for us to be agitating for the right to vote, Alva says, wrong. This is exactly the time for us to be agitating for the women's right to vote. And she's the one who makes sure that the pickets outside the White House stay up there through the years of the First World War. She puts every ounce of her own dictatorial, tyrannical, impossible, domineering personality into this battle. And what happens? Well, she's ostracized and denounced and pushed out of polite society. But on August 20th, 1920, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is ratified, and women, for the first time in history, win the right to vote. Right? And the lesson of that victory applies as equally to today as it did back then in 1920. And that is, if you deny people legitimacy, they will one day, by one means or another, come back and defeat you. Right? So one last thing. Alva dies in January of 1933. She dies of a stroke. And her funeral is held in St. Thomas Church, the same cathedral where Consuela was married so many years before. And the limousines are lined up and down Fifth Avenue. And 20 of the country's foremost feminists are her pallbearers. And the congregation sings three hymns before they put her in the ground. The first is a hymn by Harriet Beecher Stowe. The second is the suffragette battle song, right? The March of the Women. And the third is a hymn that was composed by Alva, of course. And it was all about how when she got to heaven, she would be damned if a man named St. Peter was going to sit in judgment of her. And it begins, and it's just beautiful reflection on this wonderful, crazy, fantastic woman. No waiting at the gates of paradise, no tribunal of men to judge. The watchers of the tower proclaim a daughter of the king. Thank you.